The material shared within this podcast is based on the personal experiences and learnings of the presenter. Coloplast has paid the presenter for sharing this information. Nothing within this podcast is intended to be used as medical advice and/or used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Welcome to the Coloplast Professional Bowel and Bladder Matters podcast, where we explore various important topics related to ostomies and continence.
I am your host, Karen Spriggs. I am a registered nurse and clinical specialist with Coloplast. Today's podcast guest is Dr. Mary Ellen Kelly. Dr. Mary Ellen Kelly is an assistant professor at Duke University and has been a pediatric nurse practitioner in urology since 2010. She obtained her MSN from Columbia University, Master's in Health Science Clinical Research from Duke University, and her DNP from the University of Pittsburgh. Currently, she is funded by the NIH's NIDDK and NICHD centers, as well as the CDC for ongoing clinical and translational research related to spina bifida care and lower urinary tract conditions in children, namely overactive bladder, urinary tract infections, neurogenic bladder, and bowel. She is a manuscript reviewer for 8 journals and has over 20 publications. She sits on the Research Advisory Council for the Spina Bifida Association, is an executive board member of the Pediatric Urology Nurses and Specialists Society, PUNS, and represents PUNS as an editor for the Journal of Pediatric Urology. So thank you, Dr. Mary Ellen Kelly, again for joining me today with this podcast. Can you please explain to our audience what spina bifida is and how specific programs can help transition the patient to achieve bowel continence?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me again. This has been fun. Spina bifida is the most common permanently disabling congenital defect that impacts multiple organ systems, such as the brain. It causes, in many cases, hydrocephalus, which is a swelling or fluid within the brain. It can also affect the bladder and the bowel, characterized by urinary or fecal incontinence, as well as the kidneys with potential renal failure. Can cause intellectual disabilities. It can impair mobility, especially in the lower limbs, and also can cause premature death. So spina bifida is a big problem. It is currently, the estimates are, there are over 160,000 Americans alive and living with spina bifida in the United States, and the majority of these are actually adults. Neurogenic bowel is when there's, you know, dysfunction to the nerves and the muscles of the bowel, or what controls the bowels from spina bifida, and it's experienced by over 80% of individuals with spina bifida. This causes constipation, and it causes fecal incontinence, which can lead to, obviously, constipation and fecal incontinence, but it can also lead to increased urinary incontinence, increased urinary tract infections. It can lead to shunt, so hydrocephalus often is treated with a shunt. So it can cause shunt malfunction, it can cause skin integrity issues, it can cause hemorrhoids. There are so many secondary issues that can come with neurogenic bowel physically, and then also there's quality of life impacts as well. There are a lot of different programs and devices now for individuals with neurogenic bowel, and a lot of these are kind of, you know, constantly changing. So thankfully, we have some new things in the repertoire over the last decade or so. But there are certain things out there that we think can really help individuals achieve better continence rates with their bowels, because currently our bowel continence rates across the nation are pretty poor for those with spina bifida. So we really want to work to increase these.
Excellent. And what is the lifespan bowel management protocol from the spina bifida group?
Yeah, so this is my baby. The lifespan bowel management protocol is something that the Spina Bifida Association spearheaded. They got together a group of authors, including myself, but we had several clinicians and researchers. There was Judy Thibodeau from the Spina Bifida Association. She was, again, kind of the lead on this. We also had individuals who are adults with spina bifida, and we had parents of children with spina bifida on the team. And we met every other week for several years and really worked to look at all the literature that was out there, to talk to people with spina bifida and talk to other clinicians and researchers, and really try to synthesize everything out there to make the first protocol for how to treat neurogenic bowel. The audience was really intended to be clinicians, mostly clinicians who maybe weren't well-versed at treating individuals with neurogenic bowel, but also those who are, because again, there's been changes. So we really wanted to go and start at the beginning and talk about the goals and talk about the different treatment options out there and how to move from one treatment to a next, how to prepare people for a bowel program, and really just lots of nuances. This has a lot of content to it and can really hopefully serve as a guide to treat neurogenic bowel and improve our continence rates.
Excellent. And what is the ultimate goal of a bowel program?
My goal may not be your goal, but the ultimate goal is hopefully for individuals to have continence. So to have bowel continence and poop where they want, when they want, or at least at an expected time, and also to be as independent with whatever bowel management protocol they use as possible. Again, that said, like my goal might not be aligned with one of my patients' goals. So that goal will be whatever their goal is. You know, they might be okay with having an accident here or there as long as they're able to do something independently. Others, you know, might prioritize independence over continence. Everybody's goals are different, but some combination of increased continence and independence.
Right. Every patient has a different pathway in life, you know, no matter what. And, you know, you just have to work with them to achieve what, like you said, what their ultimate goal is.
Yep, you got it.
So how often are abdominal X-rays or KUBs utilized to assess the patient's stool burden?
Oh, were you trying to get me in trouble with this question? This is a controversial question. And maybe not to all your listeners, but to those of us in the clinical realm, this is definitely a point of contention with some individuals. Abdominal X-rays, or sometimes we call them like KUBs, a lot of clinics, and including myself, we will use these sometimes as a snapshot, right? A snapshot of the belly to get an idea of how much poop is really sitting in there. But it's exactly that. It's just a snapshot of that exact moment in time. It's not a historian. It doesn't give us the whole picture. You know, if you x-ray you and I belly right now, one of us might have to poop. So it might look like we have a huge stool burden. So there's been some individuals out there who have published kind of scales and measures to use a KUB, an abdominal x-ray, to assess for constipation. So there have been actual radiology measures that you can take in a scale and say, oh, based on how much stool is in each quadrant, this person is X percent, you know, constipated. But all of the ones that have been published, all of these scales that have been previously published, have been debunked.
Oh.
Yeah, they've all now kind of been proven not to be so valid and not clinically useful. So it's a very subjective measure in that sense. We don't have that objective tool to say, you know, one picture to a next, this is kind of what's going on. So that being said, they should not, from my thought process and kind of the recommendations also from the National Association of GI, I believe in Europe and in the United States, I believe both of them have the same recommendation that KUBs really should not be used routinely to assess for stool burden, again, for the flaws we just mentioned. But that said, they definitely can be helpful in certain scenarios. So if for some reason you can't get a good physical exam on a patient, because you can assess constipation pretty well from a good physical exam. If you can't get a good history from a patient for whatever reason, or if you're concerned that there's like a true obstruction or something that's more clinically urgent, then this is a great tool. That's where a KUB comes in really handy.
And are you noticing that you may be utilizing KUBs more often nowadays due to telehealth visits or not necessarily?
Right, because I can't do a physical exam very well. I can look, but that's about it. I can't use my hands and anything. So I think there are cases, like I mentioned, this is not a routine, like, no, you should never order a KUB ever. But I think we need to be selective about when we use them. So you know, if I'm concerned that we've switched maybe a bowel protocol and the history somebody's giving me or the bowel diary they've provided, something's just not adding up. And I can't actually tell if they're backed up and having accidents or they have loose stool and that's why they're having accidents, because, you know, the bowel's fun like that. You can't figure out anything easily. Then, yeah, I might grab a KUB so that way they don't have to come all the way to clinic. They can get it done locally and I can just take a look at it and put that together with their history or their diary and really try to figure out what's going on.
In your practice, are you looking at those x-rays and not just relying on the report from the radiologist?
1,025%.
Yes, because
I love radiologists. I'm not discounting them in any fashion.
But generally just say something like mild to moderate constipation, and then you look at it and they're just chock full of stool, right?
Well, and that's it. And it's so subjective, like I mentioned, and subjective to everybody. So to the radiologist as well, they don't have a grading tool they can use for this. Like I mentioned, they've all been kind of discredited. So they're just saying like moderate stool burden, mild stool burden. And I'm like, well, that's great. Let me go look at let's go to the images, shall we?
Right.
So I like to go to the instant replay, take a look at the pictures myself, especially if you know the patient and maybe you've had some imaging in the past to compare. You know, you can even just get an idea of how distended the colon is this time versus last time, et cetera. So yes, always go to the films yourself.
Absolutely. And if you're not using a KUB or an x-ray on your patient, how are you assessing the stool burden for your patients?
Oh, that's a good question. It's hard. You know, you're going a lot off of the history, of course, from the patient. You know, how often are they going? What's the consistency of the stool? We still use the Bristol stool scale a lot and have them kind of identify what their poop looks like and the frequency. So a lot of it is history. We use the bowel diary, which is actually within the protocol. There's one in the appendix that we recommend, and it was published by one of the authors of the protocol as well. So we'll go through the diary with them, and that really can help us know, okay, this person is actually pooping, you know, every day or twice every day, and they're saying they're getting, you know, a long, skinny stool. Okay, they probably don't have a huge stool burden. Whereas if somebody's, you know, obviously less frequently stooling, or they're having, you know, we call them type one on the Bristol stool chart, but kind of those little pebbly poops, rabbit poops, then you can just tell by that history, you know? And of course, if they're in person, you can do a physical exam by percussion and palpation. Just on someone's belly, you can get a good idea of how full they are of stool because you can hear it and oftentimes you can feel it. So a good physical exam can be really helpful.
Great. Thank you. And what are the goals of patients that are not fully independent with their bowel program?
So goal one would be to help them get as independent as possible, right? So there are things we can do with clinicians, and maybe it's changing the program or tweaking it to give them independence. But a lot of individuals with spina bifida, as we mentioned, it doesn't just affect your bowels, right? It can affect a lot of mobility issues. I know we have patients who might have dexterity concerns. And so some of the bowel regimens really do require good dexterity. So those might be really difficult for them to do independently. And some individuals with spina bifida might have poor core stability. So it's very difficult for them to sit on a traditional toilet. So without, you know, a risk of a fall. So there are some barriers from kind of a physical therapy standpoint. So I think with some individuals, it's really identifying not so much the program that's working, but identifying what are their barriers to becoming independent. You know, is it a physical barrier? Do we need to figure out a way to help you with your dexterity or give you more stability? Do you need like a PT or OT assessment? OT is like amazing.
Amazing.
Like, occupational therapists, like, thank you all for your existence. But they are so creative. They're like the MacGyvers of the medicine world. And they're always coming up with these really cool tools, I feel like, for some of my patients. And they're like, oh, well, you know, if you just use this and attach gum and a string, like all the fun in, my patient can do something.
Them and child life specialists, I don't know how we worked without them in the past.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. So, but really utilizing these other individuals who are, frankly, more creative than I am but they can help. And they also know the right tools. Like physical therapy will know, oh, we need this specific type of chair or toilet seat or adapter that's really going to help you be able to carry out your bowel program by yourself. And a lot of health insurances will cover, you know, these other assessments like an OT assessment, et cetera. The other thing, if that's not sufficient, is looking out for the care provider. So whether it's a parent or a partner, whomever it is, or even a paid health professional who's helping somebody with their bowel program, we kind of want to be protective of them as well, making sure that there is more than one person who knows how to help the person with spina bifida on their bowel program, because we don't want to funnel it so it's one person only who knows what they're doing and how to do it safely. We really need to make sure that there's multiple people so that if someone's at work, someone is sick, someone's away on vacation, doing something awesome, that there's a backup. If the person cannot do a bowel program themselves, we need multiple other humans who are willing and able to do it for them or with them.
Agreed. Yes, that's such a crucial point that there's just more than one person that knows how to do it in the household. Completely agree.
So there have been some great studies out there looking at caregiver burden from, I believe, Indianapolis and Pittsburgh. And, you know, there is a big caregiver burden on individuals with spina bifida, but specifically neurogenic bowel, because the majority, the very large majority of individuals on a bowel program cannot do it independently, unfortunately. So it's something we do need to focus on. So
it can take a long time too.
Yeah. And you know, you expect in a kid that of course you're going to need some help, but it's a very low rate of individuals who can do this independently as adults. So because of that, I think less than 25% of individuals with spina bifida can be independent right now with their bowel program.
Wow.
So yes, so that's a big quote unquote burden, but it's a healthcare burden on somebody else. These individuals who are the care providers or care partners, they're reporting pretty low rates of quality of life, and it's specific to the care of the neurogenic bowel. It's a time consuming program. Yeah. It revolves a lot of cleanup, you know, after. And let's be honest, poop isn't the most pleasant bodily substance to work with all the time.
That's right. Yes.
So, and these are the things that these care partners also cite as being the biggest issues for them.
Can you please explain the stepwise approach to bowel management?
Oh, sure. So this is really a focus, and this has come out over the last maybe less than a decade, really as a focus on how we treat and manage neurogenic bowel. But it's really making sure that we are moving along from one kind of type of bowel program to the next in a sequential fashion, like a real smart way. We want to start with the least invasive type of intervention. So that's usually like your oral medications, right? And then move on in a stepwise fashion to more invasive. So we usually go from like oral medications to digital rectal stimulation, to suppositories, to enemas. Then we move on to our like cone or balloon enemas. Then you move on to transanal irrigations. And finally, your surgical options like maces, cecostomies, chafes, and further than that, colostomies or ileostomies. So we're really moving from a least invasive to a more invasive. And we call it stepwise also because we want you to take each step separately, but also in a quasi-quick fashion. So we don't want somebody stagnating in something like oral meds or suppositories that's not working for a long time. You know, if you switch to something at the advice of a clinician, you try it out for 2 weeks, you check back in, nope, not working. Okay, let's make a little change. And you do that a few times and it's totally not working, then we want to move on. So I think in the protocol, we say, you know, we'll check in at 2 weeks, maybe again at 2 weeks. If after 30 days or so, it's just not working, then it's time to move to the next step. And it's not combining the steps. It is moving all the way to the next step and starting again. With the caveat being, you know, some of those bigger things like cone enemas, transanal irrigations and surgeries, those are going to take longer for your body to adjust to. But the same idea, we want you to move on. If it's not working, okay, let it go. Let's get on to the next thing.
why are clinics still using cone enemas or Foley balloon enemas as compared to going straight to a transanal irrigation system?
I think there's a lot of reasons. You've got the obvious insurance reason. So not all insurance plans, not in every state, can you get a transanal irrigation device. Cone enemas and Foley enemas, again, Foley enemas are essentially free if you just have a Foley enema on hand somewhere. Cone enemas are very cheap, so they can sometimes just be the reason. Otherwise, sometimes with little children, it's easier to do a balloon or a cone, especially a Foley enema in a really young child. And there's also just a preference by some people. They don't want to kind of invest in the training and everything else that might go into a transanal irrigation, and they'd prefer to stick with a cone. I know in our office, my practice, we generally will go to the cone enemas before doing a transanal irrigation, just because it's something I can just give them in clinic that day. You know, I have a stockpile, I give them one, I train them that day, we send them home, and then I, you know, fill out my DME order for them to get more shipped. But they can start it immediately. I don't think it's very intimidating to them because they're already used to doing either suppositories or enemas first. So it's a nice, easy step. And it has pretty good results. So it can work really well for individuals. And then I think most of the time when we move from a cone to a transanal irrigation, it's usually not because continence isn't the problem. I feel like it's independence. You know, people want to no longer have somebody holding this cone against their bottom or inserting the Foley in and blowing up the balloon. They want to be able to do it a little better themselves, and they want it to be faster. And generally, transanal irrigation is going to be a quicker routine than a cone is. So that transition, I think, is usually a pretty good transition. Rather, a successful transition is maybe a better way to state it. There's also just some preference and tradition within the clinics of what to do.
Right. And then with the transanal irrigation, if you've gotten that route and the patients mm-hmm. are doing amazing, then they usually don't even have to go to the surgical options. But you haven't burned any bridges, we'll say. If they try transanal irrigation and it's just not for them, then they can certainly be recommended for a surgical option. Is correct, right?
Yeah, that's totally right. We published a study not that long ago, looking at the data from the National Spina Bifida Patient Registry, which is housed at the CDC with the NIH. We looked at basically bowel continence and independence for each of the different kind of like mainstream bowel management options. And we found that 60% of the individuals who were able to have continence were able to be continent without actually having surgery.
That's amazing, because so many of these spina bifida kiddos, you know, they've had so many surgeries over time that they don't want to have another surgery. They don't want to have another hole in their belly or anything of that sort. So to have other options than surgery for these patients are just so amazing.
And I think that was kind of a eye-opening finding, because I think traditionally the gold standard has kind of always been like proceed to a mace or an ace or a costochostomy, some sort of surgical intervention for the bowels. Right. And then we said, hey, guys, we're actually 60% of these people are continent without having to have an additional surgery. Like, that is a lot. So more work needs to be done on that, of course. But I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said about these lesser invasive measures and that they can be really great for a lot of our patients.
Agreed. Individuals with spina bifida are at a greater risk for maltreatment, including physical and sexual abuse. What can mm-hmm. clinicians do to screen for this potential abuse?
Okay, this is a really great question and a really important topic that is definitely not as commonly addressed as maybe it should be. So we do know that individuals with spina bifida, they are, and this is hugely important, they are at an increased risk of physical and sexual abuse. I think this needs to be like shouted from the rooftops to clinicians and care providers and parents and teachers, just to be on the lookout. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it, but I don't think we can ignore the fact that a lot of these kids, as we mentioned, they're not independent with their bowel routines. And I'm going to just say also with their bladder routines, right? A lot of them are on clean intermittent catheterizations and they require help. These are really intimate programs and processes to empty their bladder and bowel. Obviously, they're also done through your urethra and your rectum. Like, you're right there. And there's an increased risk of sexual abuse. And also, a lot of these individuals have decreased sensation. So they might not even be able to feel what's going on, which is kind of scary, I think.
And sad.
It's terrible. So from a clinician standpoint, I think it's important, one, that clinicians are aware of this. Two, I think they need to discuss this with parents right off the bat, and then with the children as soon as it's appropriate, as soon as it's like age and developmentally appropriate, so that they're aware, and really empowering parents, but more specifically the kids, that, you know, if you're at school and all of a sudden your aide who normally helps you with your bathroom routine is not there and some other random person is coming in, like, that's not okay. You know, and you can say, no, I don't feel comfortable in this situation. Like, really giving that empowerment of, you know, it is your body. This, if you feel uncomfortable in any situation, you can tell people to stop, and that is okay. Even if you, you know, have to miss that cath, or they have to call your mom or dad to come in and do it instead, that's okay. We want you safe. So I think that's a big piece. Empowering the families, empowering the child, letting clinicians know. Also making sure that all the individuals kind of approve and know who is helping with any of these intimate processes, right, or procedures. So they know who they are, they feel okay with these individuals, and that we're training them appropriately. And I think that's really, really big. And of course, physical exam, right? Old school physical exam and history taking. So, you know, when you're doing an exam on a patient, you want to look for any signs of potential trauma, or if someone's getting a lot of infections we didn't expect, or whatnot, and asking the child if they feel safe, you know, having those frank conversations with them.
Yes, agreed. And getting back to the school, you know, to have somebody as a backup, because we know people get sick, right?
Yeah.
So their first aide may be sick, but there should be somebody that's, you know, potential that can be the backup there at school to help or assist with these patients is so vitally important. And, you know, just to get that word out to the schools that they need to have a backup for these patients with, you know, healthcare needs that are in the private area, you know, so just to have them be able to help those patients overall, I think is really important for their physical, mental well-being, and just to decrease that physical and sexual abuse on these patients. It's vitally important. So,
yeah, I mean, we've all, you know, heard those terrible stories out there of things. And, you know, some of it's just even the fact that there's not private places to for someone to go and get a catheterization done. And so they're, you know, I've heard of schools where the aide is catheterizing a child just like kind of like on a floor in a bathroom. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I have so many concerns with this, right? You have,
right,
besides hygiene and everything else, but you've got people walking in and out of the bathroom.
Right.
It's just very inappropriate. So making sure there's a plan, making sure, like you said, there's a backup, the schools are aware, and the child is aware and comfortable with who is there and what they're doing.
Right. There's so many tools out on the market nowadays that they can utilize to maybe if they don't have a bathroom, that they can catheterize into a bag or whatever the case may be. So there's so many options out there that can be explored by these families. So I do hope that they listen to these podcasts and know that there's help out there for them if they need it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Bowel and Bladder Matters podcast, part of Coloplast Professional, where we believe clinician education related to ostomies and continence matters. For more educational resources from Coloplast, visit us at coloplast.us/professional.